You're listening to the Writers Forum. I'm your host, Mike Tusa, and today I'll be speaking with author Noelle Salazar about her new book, The Roaring Days of Zora Lilly. Noelle's debut novel, The Flight Girls, was a USA Today bestseller. Now, folks, she has been an NFL cheerleader, a medical assistant, and a Navy recruit. Welcome to the show, Noelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so we have to start off with the most important question right off the bat. Which team were you an NFL cheerleader for? I'm going to guess Seattle, but...
You would be correct.
All right, because I did pick up that you like Seattle. All right, let's talk, though, about the about writing. So you've had all these different careers. What is it that made you turn to writing, or were you always a writer?
I was always a storyteller for sure. Like I've always said, I've never been bored in my life. We'd, you know, go car trips to grandma's house. I was just always sitting in the back seat, stuffed between my three siblings, imagining. My first memory, I was 3 years old, waiting for my family to get organized so we could take a family picture, and I was just standing there imagining. So I've just constantly been telling myself stories, but I was actually just talking with some middle school kids and who had asked that same question. And it made me think about when I was their age, how I didn't have what they have, this access. So I always loved writing and I loved creating stories, but I never thought I could be a writer because I didn't know what that looked like. And they can go on YouTube and like look up interviews like this. And so they can get more of a sense of what it is to be a writer and how to be a writer and get actual instruction on how to be a writer. You know, the querying process and everything like that. So I always was writing stories, creating stories, but I never thought I could actually like do it as a career. So finding that out, you know, in my 30s and 40s was really exciting to me. So I'm getting to live my dream now, which is fantastic. I finally made it.
The book we're going to talk about is really good. I imagine the other ones are as well, although I haven't read those. I've only read this one. Now, let's talk about the book. Take a step back for a moment. I saw an interview that you did where you said part of the book is a love letter to Seattle. Talk about that a little bit before we turn to the characters and the genesis of the actual book.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read many stories that take place in my city, especially during the 20s. And I love the 20s. I think it's a really special pocket of time. So for me, and also my family, this is where we, you know, a lot of us come from, grew up. The name Zora Lilly comes from my great-great-grandmother. The real Zora Lilly and her husband Horatio came down from Canada and settled in Seattle. Back in the early 1900s, they did live in a logging camp with their 8 children. And so to me, I just wanted to like talk about my city because also as I kind of started delving into the time period, the logging camps, I learned so much about the city and the culture, the jazz culture, the downtown, and it just became very exciting to me. And I just wanted to share it. And so it was kind of an honor to get to put it in this book and hope people kind of fall in love with what I've fallen in love with.
Well, you touched on something I was going to ask you about, actually two things. But the first is, did you have to do some research to educate yourself about Seattle during that time period?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it was so interesting. Just again, it's that culture, like where the jazz, the speakeasies, the prohibition, like where this was all taking place, how it was all working, the police force, how, you know, that was taking place, what was happening there. Really interesting little kind of nuggets of information that I found that were fun and funny and that I got to put in the book. Definitely so much research, but yeah, that's like part of my favorite thing about historical fiction is like just those things you get to find out and hope to get to put in your book.
And maybe in another book at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You just can't hang on to it just in case. Yeah.
So now authors will sometimes tell me they started their book with a character idea or a plot idea. Yours is actually kind of interesting, and you alluded to this earlier, and it's in, I think, the author's note or something like that in your book. Yours started, I think, with finding out your great-grandmother's name. Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
How did you find that out?
So I was at a memorial service for another family member, and my mom and my aunt just started talking about our history. My aunt had just, you know, done the deep dive on ancestry.com, and she was researching my maternal grandmother's her relatives. And so she just starts talking about Horatio and Zora Lily, and I had never heard their names. I knew my grandmother's mother's name, which was one of Zora Lily's daughters. So I knew my great-grandmother's name, and I knew she had all these siblings, but I never knew her parents' names. And so this was the first moment that I had ever heard their names, and I was shocked that this name, this fantastic name, had never been passed down in any form. There are no Zoras, there are no Lilies, there's no Zora Lily for sure. And I was just, like, shocked. And so I thought, she needs a story. I'm gonna make her a story. It's not her story by any means, but I just wanted to put her name on the cover of a book and give her something. So,
well, and how much of the story, which we're going to talk about a little bit more, how much of the story is actually part of your great-great-grandmother's backstory that you learned about in researching?
Definitely, you know, the logging history. Now, Zora and her husband, they actually, the real, lived in a logging camp. The logging history is theirs. The poverty is definitely theirs. The many, many kids is theirs. But there are names like Zora's last name is Huff, and that was our family name, though it was a different spelling. And there are names that are kind of peppered throughout the story that are family names. So for my family, it's really fun to read and find these little Easter eggs.
Yeah, yeah. So where does the name Zora come from? You know, I'm Sicilian on both sides, and so you have a custom of naming your kids after their grandfather, right, or their grandmother.
Right, yeah.
Where does Zora, do you know where that came from?
I have no idea. And now that you just said that, now I want to go find out. I don't know if I can find
it. I couldn't wonder if it was maybe short for something longer, what it would be short for, but you're not sure.
I'm not sure. And I know that my aunt was able to go further back in that line. So I wonder if she knows. I know Horatio's kind of stopped with Horatio. We couldn't find much more. But now you've put me on a mission.
Good. I'm glad I've given you an assignment.
I like that. Yeah.
In the book, you have dual narratives, okay? One occurs mostly in the 1920s and the other in 2023. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious about this all the time. Did you write the narratives separately and then incorporate them, or did you write going back and forth?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I originally, there was no present day story. I had gone through this whole thing where I had lost my editor, got a new editor, and during our first discussion about the book. It was just set in the 1920s, Zora's story, that she said, hey, I'm thinking that it might be good to add this element. And I was like, right. Because I had at that point zero ideas, but we just started spitballing, which is one of my favorite things to do when I'm creating a story, is just like to talk to someone and start throwing things back and forth. And she at one point was like, I don't know, maybe there's something with a label. And I could just see it suddenly. And I was like, I've got it. So I took inspiration from the movie A League of Their Own, which also bookends the story. So I did that because also like I like that you are sitting in Zora's story. I didn't want to pull out. I mean, sometimes I have trouble reading dual stories when they go back and forth too much. I'm always in love with one aspect of the story more than the other, so then I get irritated. So I was like, well, I think this actually works out because you get to just sit in Zora's story and have this kind of bookended moment. I didn't think the present day story needed to be like that much involved. So I just think it worked out perfectly for this story.
Well, I think it works really well, but I'm always curious when you have the dual narratives also about how you make sure that it doesn't break the narrative so much that people, you know, kind of throw up their hands, which it doesn't here. It works really well. But how did you decide, since you did write it after the fact, where to insert these jump backs or jump forwards, I should say, to 2023?
I mean, it is kind of just like, it's so hard to explain, but it's just a feeling, you know, like you just sort of, the natural flow of the story. I think because I watch so many movies, so much TV, read so many books, I think you naturally, when you do that, when you consume story so much, you kind of just get a feel of like where that would naturally happen.
So for folks that listen that might be writing or hoping to write or whatever, did you have any trial and error with that where, you know, you stuck 2023 in somewhere and then looked at it and said, I don't think this is going to work, let me move it? or did it just work?
It just, I mean, part of it could be laziness.
It's not. It works well. So whatever you did worked. But
thank you. I felt like it just worked for this story. Okay. I have another story coming out this year, and it does go back and forth a little bit, not that much. But again, it was sort of just like, where does this naturally fit? Where is it not going to like be distracting?
Right.
So I think it is a balance. I think that, and there are people that do it beautifully. They get that back and forth balance done so well. I haven't done it a lot yet, so I'm a little more nervous about it.
Well, you got a good start. Well, let's talk real quickly about 2023 then. So this involves mostly a character named Sylvia, who works at the Smithsonian Museum of American History as a costume curator. I didn't know what that was. Now, you know, I'm 66 and male, so it's probably best that I don't know what that is. But what is a costume curator?
They are the magicians that take care of, you know, costumes, gowns from like things like the Met Gala or Oscar, these beautiful, famous dresses that, you know, celebrities wear. And they care for them. It's sort of described in the book how, you know, there's like forms put under these costumes and dresses and stuff to keep their shape. But just trying to keep the integrity of the fabric so that they can, you know, be viewed and, you know, through the years. I mean, my ex-husband actually works in art. I can't even think of words now. He conserves art. He repairs art. So he was a good, like, hey, how would this work? And so he was good to ask about that. But, you know, I did a lot of research on that, too, just trying to figure out, like, you know, that there were, like, actual forms and stuff they would have to lay costumes and dresses on just to keep, like, the form of, like, the human that wore it. To keep the integrity of these costumes and dresses. It's just another sort of art form of keeping art alive.
You know, what I thought worked really well, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, is that it also gave the story. So nobody knew who Zora Lily was. And then Sylvia suddenly discovers this tag. So it just lent something really neat to the story that here's a forgotten person that now suddenly is being remembered. And it made it easier to believe Zora's overall story as you learn that. All right. Yeah. So did you go to the museum, by the way, to check any of that out, or just did your research?
I just did my research. I've been there years before. So I've gone through, you know, the exhibits, but I didn't go specifically for this, especially because it was basically a last minute add on. So I had to come up with this quickly. So it was really just deep dive into like the bare necessities of what would bring this to life.
All right. The novel also has musical references, which I love. Okay. But you had to go back and obviously learn what the musical references were during the 20s, right? Yes. How did you go about doing that?
I found some really wonderful books. One by Paul DeBarros. He does jazz, like articles still to this day for the Seattle Times. And he wrote this book that basically chronicles, especially Oscar Holden during the 20s, his music and his like legacy. So again, it was just like finding books. And that one was hard to find. I had to go on eBay and like spend $50 for that book because it's not sold in stores anymore. But it was just a lot of like who were the musicians in Seattle at that time and what, you know, how big were they? What was their importance? What were the clubs? You know, where would they have been playing? Which was really fun, you know, and they were on Jackson Street and these were the clubs they played in. And this was the culture of that club and finding the culture of the clubs that was interesting too, because they all had their kind of different, how they worked was different depending on who owned it. And so, yeah, but it was, again, just a lot of books and online research, listening to music, which was really fun.
So you did listen to some of the music.
Oh yes, I still have on my playlist. It'll just come up, which is really fun.
Well, you know, what it did for me, not just because I'm a music lover, but it kind of gave us a broad brush of the environment during that time period, which I thought was really fun. Now, I'm old enough to know who this person was. Greta Garbo makes an appearance in the book. Talk to us about why, first of all, who was Greta Garbo and why she shows up in the story? in Zora's story.
She was one of the first, you know, movie stars, female movie stars. And I don't know, you know, I went through this sort of very small list of who was famous at that time, and who would have made like maybe an impact on Zora, on fashion, and who was in the movies at that time. And she was just beautiful, and she has such a beautiful kind of legacy. And so I chose her, or maybe she chose me, I don't know. But yeah, that was really fun. It was fun to just kind of, cause I mean, there were others to choose from, for sure. But I don't know, there was something about her, her presence in all the pictures I was looking at that I just thought, you know, it would be kind of just this fun pairing with little, you know, Zora, quiet Zora. Yeah, so.
Again, back to painting that broad picture. All right, there are two other characters in the book that I liked, Ellis and Jesse, okay? Now, like Zora, they have dreams, and you've done a good job in the book of talking about what Zora's dreams were. But for Ellis and Jesse, they're problems, right?
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
I mean, yeah. So Ellis, I love Ellis, and I would love to just tell Ellis's story from beginning to end. He became very much a favorite character of mine. Yeah, you know, he's just trying to make his way in the music business, and you know, in an interracial relationship with Zora's best friend, and all the stress that can bring about. And I will say, when I first wrote it, I did shy away a little bit from writing his character. You do have to be careful, you know. I am a white woman writing a black character, but I also wanted to very much respect the culture and be realistic about what that time was like, you know. Even though things were very much kind of out in the open down below in the clubs, they weren't necessarily up on the street. And I really just wanted to tell that story a little bit and give Ellis life and a life. And so it was just fun, like bringing him into kind of Oscar's world and just kind of giving him some success and bringing him back around in the end. So you do get to see that he is thriving. And I like to imagine that he went on to just, you know, blow some doors down in the Seattle music world.
Well, it was a tough time. You had miscegenation laws, I imagine, up in Seattle as well. They were mostly across the whole country. And tell us a little bit about Jesse.
And Jessie's just fun. She's just a spark plug. And I just loved, like, just her, you know, her also trying to, you know, she's sort of masking herself. And just, again, just trying to make it in this world that's, you know, is not necessarily going to be agreeable for her when she's a woman, when she is a woman of color, which she's, you know, lucky, I don't know if that's the word, but can sort of mask. And so I feel like, you know, she was struggling with who she is, who she was born as, and trying to just, you know, make it in this world. And, you know, I just like to think that all of my characters, except for the terrible ones, thrive. And,
she has the same dreams as Zora, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right. But she just has some additional hurdles, significant hurdles in some ways, to accomplishing the same things. So you're talking about characters. And I know one of the things when I get feedback, listeners are most surprised when they hear an author say, I'm going to ask you about it. And that is that if you create good characters, they help write the book.
Yes.
Did you have that experience with this book? And if so, was there one character that prompted you a little more than the others?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel that is true. I'm a horrible outliner.
You fly by the seat of your pants, right?
I do a lot. I did try and outline this one a bit. And I remember I got to like chapter 17 and then I had apparently stopped outlining because I went back to my outline and I was like, oh, I don't know what happens next. I don't actually start a story unless I know how it ends. So I do know that, like I know where I'm going, but I do find it really fun to let my characters sort of take me. And Zora definitely was the one that led this story. But there are moments of like, Harley showed up at a gate where she works. And I was like, what are you doing there? Like, I wasn't expecting him to show up. And so that's always a fun moment for me when my characters just sort of do their own thing. I really like this sense of like the characters, they tell me the story and right. I just sort of sit back a lot of the time and just see where it goes. And if they start kind of going down the wrong road, we try and corral them back. But
or as one writer said, I'm paraphrasing, if you start going down the wrong road, they pull you back in, right?
That's true, you know, too.
I'm not going to do that, right?
Well, we didn't want that guy to die. Stop it. Yeah, you know?
Right. Yeah. All right. Let me end with this question, I guess. So you're creating fictional characters, okay? You put them in circumstances that they have to figure their way out of. What do you learn about yourself when you do that?
Oh, gosh. It is therapy, I will say. It is definitely therapy. I will say on a personal note, my second book put me in therapy because it was dealing with teenage girls going through a lot of trauma, and I had trauma in my teenage years, and I was like, oh, apparently we're going to deal with that now. There are definitely, I will say, things that you learn about yourself that you don't mean to, that you don't intend to, but as you're putting your characters through things and they're trying to find their way out of it, you're like, oh, this is a life lesson for myself, you know, or this is something I do. So, I mean, sometimes I feel like you do it purposefully. You give them something of yourself and maybe work through it. And sometimes you do it accidentally. And so like with my second book, that was a complete accident. Didn't realize I was going to be putting myself through some stuff. But with Zora, I mean, I feel like a lot of my main characters have a similarity where they're just very hopeful and they persevere. And they aren't necessarily willing to be told no, or if they are told no, they're going to find another way. And I like to think that I am aspiring to be like that. Not necessarily that quite yet. But as I look back at my, you know, it's not such a long writing career so far. I definitely see the parallels of my own writing career with their careers of just persevering and keep going. And when I have been told no, I just kept writing and here we are. So,
well, you know, you said something, so I am going to ask you another one. And this is just a personal observation and you can tell me, I don't know what I'm talking about, or you can tell me. So my experience with, I don't know, 90 plus writers that I've interviewed, is if they've had trauma, if they've been marginalized when they're younger, they have a deeper need to go below the veneer of everyday living into the hardwood, right?
Yeah. And
that impacts the writing that they do. Have mm-hmm. you found that to be true in your case, since you alluded to trauma when you were younger?
Yeah, definitely. it does make me, I don't know, seek truth.
Do you have a greater need? I don't know how else to say this. A greater need to be known at a deeper level?
Yes. Yeah. I do feel like, you know, when I'm writing, I hope people, I don't know, just like a sense, like just sense. You know, I feel like sometimes I can't get the words maybe necessarily right, but I'm like, please feel this, like, please, like, feel my pain or feel my absolute sincerity in this moment, and like hold on to it for yourself, or like, and I do feel like, I mean, I've gotten emails from people that have definitely found those things. I had this one woman, she's actually a bookseller, she had a quote from my first book tattooed down her spine, and I was like, that is,
hope it was a good one. Yes.
Beautiful. I was like, I wrote that. It was, you know, you forget too what you write, but it was, you know, just this really lovely moment of somebody finding that little thing I dropped in there.
Yeah. Well, what you're talking about really, and this is what makes a good book like Zora Lily, is universal themes. No matter where people are from or what their background is, if it's something they can identify with, And I think they can with Zora's story that works. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Folks, you've been listening to the Writers Forum, and I've been speaking with author Noelle Salazar about her new novel, The Roaring Days of Zora Lilly. Is there a website or a social media site that folks can go to learn more about you and to learn more about the book?
Yes. You can go to noellesalazar.com, or you can find me. I'm usually on Instagram at Noelle_Salazar.
And Noelle is spelled N-O-E-L-L-E, folks, right? Okay. Yes. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Folks, good. Folks, the music for the show has been provided by Valerie Hunt Jester. It's produced by our very own Del Agnew. Tune in next Tuesday at 4 o'clock or Wednesday at 5:30 in the morning to hear the next segment of the Writers Forum.